Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Walk your talk.
Talk your talk. KGNU Talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30
on KGNU.
Good morning and welcome to Connections. I'm Joel Edelstein. Last August, Dr. Nader Hashemi, director of the Middle East Center at the University of Denver Joseph Korbel School of International Studies, was the guest on a podcast hosted by the respected journalist Negar Montazavi, a critic of the Iranian regime. Most of the half-hour interview is devoted to the history of ethics in Islamic religion and the Muslim world, and particularly in Shia Iran. The discussion includes Salman Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses, and why it incited such rage in Iran. Then Ms. Montazavi asks Dr. Hashemi to turn to current events, and particularly to the attack earlier in August on author Salman Rushdie, whether the negotiations between Iran and the West to restore the 2015 nuclear arms deal had a role in the timing of the attack on Rushdie. Please pay attention to Dr. Hashemi's words in the remaining 2 minutes of the podcast.
One of the things that I thought about when I first heard about this attack is sort of, you know, what explains the timing? That's the obvious sort of social science, you know, question that you have. Why is this happening now? Is it just a coincidence, which is one possibility? Or are there nefarious political forces at stake here that are responsible for this attack? So one possible explanation could be that, you know, after the assassination of Iran's top general in January 2020, Qasem Soleimani, Iran was looking to retaliate. And the Department of Justice, about a few days before the attack on Salman Rushdie, announced that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps were seeking to assassinate Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. So this could be one possible explanation. They couldn't go after Pompeo and Bolton. In other words, the IRGC couldn't go after those high-value targets. So they chose a soft target such as Salman Rushdie. Perhaps, possibly, we don't know. The other possibility, which I actually think is much more likely, is that this young kid, Hadi Matar, was in communication with someone online who claimed to be an Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps supporter and lured him into attacking Salman Rushdie. And that so-called person online claiming to be affiliated with the Islamic Republic of Iran could have been a Mossad operative. Israel has taken a very strong position against reviving the Iran nuclear agreement. We were in very sensitive negotiations. It looked like an agreement was imminent. And then the attack on Salman Rushdie takes place. I think that's one possible interpretation and scenario that could explain the timing of this at this moment. During these sensitive political discussions related to Iran's nuclear program. So those are some of my thoughts on the politics of this attack against the writer Salman Rushdie.
And these words of Dr. Nader Hashemi, the director of the Middle East Center at the University of Denver, these remarks made headlines around the world. He was attacked and condemned for including among those who might have influenced 24-year-old Hadi Matar to attack Rushdie, the Israeli intelligence unit, the Mossad. The leaders of the University of Denver refused to defend Dr. Hashemi. Well, I wish that the circumstances were different, but I am pleased to welcome Dr. Nader Hashemi and also former University of Denver Professor Rob Prince, who was a colleague of Nader's before Rob's retirement. Thanks to you both for being here on Connections this morning.
Thanks, Joel.
Yep, thank you, Joel.
Well, Nader, 10 days ago, you announced your upcoming departure from Denver University to take up a position at another university which has affirmed to you its commitment to academic freedom. And you addressed a panel on academic freedom describing what has taken place. I want to share with our audience a portion of that presentation, but first, is there anything that you wanted to put in here to introduce what we're about to hear?
Yes, I just wanted to say that there's a bit more to the story than you just summarized. The University of Denver not only refused to support me after I was subjected to a vicious hate campaign, including death threats, but the University of Denver actually participated in the defamation campaign by issuing a statement condemning me after they were heavily lobbied by private interest groups, thus adding to this frenzied atmosphere that not only threatened my academic freedom, but also, you know, threatened my life. So that's an important part of the story here, is the total and complete moral malfeasance of the senior leadership of the University of Denver with respect to this scandal.
Let's hear more now. Dr. Hashemi's remarks on April 10th of this year to a panel on academic freedom, and then we'll return live. By the way, we will be taking your calls at our studio line, 303-442-4242.
After being heavily lobbied by outside private interest groups, the chancellor and the provost of this university have repeatedly and egregiously violated and undermined my academic freedom. I believe I've been treated as a second-class citizen by the senior leadership here. I've been subjected to discriminatory treatment. These events are directly connected to an orchestrated public defamation campaign, an intimidation campaign by mostly Netanyahu and Trump supporters here in Colorado, who have deliberately targeted me for my support on one issue, Palestinian human rights. A hostile and toxic work environment has been created that has made it increasingly difficult for me to teach courses on the Middle East and to direct a Center for Middle East Studies here at the Corbell School. I did have a dialogue, two meetings with the Chancellor and the Provost to resolve these issues, but it was a dialogue of the deaf. The University of Denver continues to stand by their morally obscene statement that they issued last August after being heavily lobbied by right-wing supporters of Israel that defamed me, questioned my character, and impugned my public reputation. Rather than defend me, senior officials of the University of Denver effectively functioned as lawyers for my outside accusers. As a result of these events, I was forced to look for employment elsewhere, and I did receive an offer and accepted it at another university, and I have written guarantees that my new institution actually will uphold academic freedom, specifically and particularly in the context of Israel-Palestine. So my training is in political theory. I get paid to theorize. When I attempted to do that last summer, as Tom summarized at the outset, I was subject to a severe attack by several Colorado Jewish organizations that condemned me. I was accused of, quote, scapegoating Jews for intervening in international affairs and echoing ancient blood libels that reek of anti-Semitism. CNN's Jake Tapper, in a since-deleted tweet, amplified this message with my photo that accused me of being a, quote, pro-Iranian regime academic spreading a vile form of Jew hatred. A media frenzy with me as the target soon developed. In late August, early September, I was subjected to a massive amount of hate mail, including several death threats and a massive amount of negative media coverage, mostly on right-wing social media, accusing me of being a terrorist, an anti-Semite, an enemy of Western civilization, a threat to national security of the United States, etc. Several Republican congressmen in Washington, D.C. also weighed in on this topic. They promised to launch a congressional investigation into the University of Denver for treasonous activities. And if you actually read the report, it sounded like an effort to resurrect the infamous House Committee on un-American activities during the Joe McCarthy era. The University of Denver's statement falsely and unjustly condemned me, and I believe deeply contributed to a climate of intimidation, harassment, and persecution, indirectly forcing me to start looking for employment elsewhere. When I appealed to the university for help, to simply issue a corrective statement that would clear my name and my reputation and affirm simply that I am a faculty member in good standing at this university, who after 14 years has made an intellectual contribution to this institution, I was repeatedly rebuffed. On two occasions in face-to-face meetings with the chancellor and the provost, I made this request. Jeremy Hafter and Mary Clark repeatedly said no. No statement of this nature would be forthcoming. In a follow-up email correspondence, I again asked the chancellor and provost to do the right thing. They again repeatedly denied my request. When I asked my dean here at this school if he could publish a statement that actually simply reflected my scholarly, teaching, intellectual, and administrative contribution to the Corvell School, in the midst of a vicious public defamation campaign, he said, "Nodder, I would really like to do so, but I have to ask myself the following question. Quote, is this the hill I want to die on?" And I took this to mean that the chancellor would extract severe consequences on the dean of the Corvell School if he didn't toe the party line as set out by the chancellor. So let the record show that at a key moment in my career at the University of Denver, when the Likud lynch mob came after me, rather than defending me or protecting me or supporting me, the chancellor of this university effectively handed the lynch mob the rope to hang me. And if you think I'm overstating my case or exaggerating what happened, consider this fact that was recently brought to my attention. In the context of this scandal, the chancellor of this university wanted to shut down our Center for Middle East Studies, close it down, shut the doors, terminate it. At this moment, I can't reveal my source, but I have it on good authority that that was indeed his plan of action. He wanted to do this because I was a headache for him. He wanted to do this because he was being heavily lobbied from the outside to fire me, to rein me in, to silence me. And let's be clear, the chancellor doesn't care about anything that I have to say on any topic in the world, on any of the 20 plus countries that constitute the Middle East and North Africa. I was a headache for this chancellor for one particular reason and for one particular topic, the Israel-Palestine conflict, or more specifically, because of the question of Palestine. This desire to shut down our Center for Middle East Studies, I think, highlights the breadth and the depth of the moral malfeasance emanating from the office of the chancellor of this university. Academic freedom, anyone? There was a previous incident the summer before that was a prelude to what happened a year later, where the provost of this university egregiously violated my academic freedom, again due to pressure from the outside. I don't have time to get into the details, but if you ask me about it during the Q&A, I would be happy to elaborate. So given the nature, the depth, and the breadth of this scandal, I'm now publicly calling for an independent and transparent investigation into this crisis. Let this investigation talk to the key players in this drama, subpoena key witnesses, examine the factual and documentary record, and then issue a report. This is what needs to happen at this university to clear the air, to restore the reputation of DU, to affirm the principle of academic freedom, and to justly resolve this issue and finally put it behind us. Now, I won't be around to see this investigation come to fruition. I'm more than happy to come back to Denver at my own expense to participate in this inquiry, but I firmly believe that after such an investigation is complete, the factual and documentary record will clearly reveal that senior leaders of this university are guilty of the abuse of power, conspiracy, discrimination, and the egregious violation of academic freedom. A transparent and independent investigation is how serious universities deal with controversies of this nature. It's up to the faculty, the staff, the students, and the Board of Trustees to decide whether this step is warranted. I believe it is. And if the Chancellor and the Provost are proud of their treatment of me, and if they have nothing to hide or apologize for, then they should welcome such an investigation because it will exonerate them. And if they oppose the investigation, well, then you can draw your own conclusions. Now, teaching in the area of Middle East studies and having an opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict is a vocation, as Karen sort of mentioned, that comes with severe risks in terms of your job security, your public reputation, and often an acrimonious relationship with senior university officials. If you have the audacity to periodically, I want to emphasize periodically, defend the human rights of the Palestinian people, or to advance a public argument, as I have done, that Palestinians and Israelis are entitled to the same human and national rights, you can be attacked by extremist supporters of the State of Israel. You'll be called an anti-Semite, you'll be accused of threatening the safety of Jewish students on campus, and sometimes your own employer will participate in your public vilification. You'll also get placed on a watch list, where past statements that you have made will be quoted out of context to smear you as a bigot, a conspiracy theorist, a supporter of terrorism, and sometimes all three. I've personally been targeted, as Karen mentioned, by Campus Watch and now its new iteration called the Canary Mission, two hate groups with ties to the Likud lobby in this country. Every word I utter in public, every sentence I write, every interview I give is closely scrutinized and monitored by these hate groups. And this is exactly what happened to me last summer when I gave the interview that sparked this crisis. And I want you all to know that this crisis that erupted last summer that Tom began in terms of describing very accurately was a totally and completely manufactured crisis. It was fake. It was a premeditated crisis. It was a ruse. I have a friend who has this obscure podcast, very small listenership. It's called the Iran Podcast. Literally, it has about 10 listeners. Due to funding problems, it's now been shut down. Very few people in this country know about the podcast or even listen to it. When I appeared on this podcast at the end of the summer, when everyone was on vacation, unbeknownst to me, these right-wing hate groups that I just referenced were monitoring my every word. They seized on a passing comment that I made, took it out of context, totally distorted my remarks, ran with it, and unfortunately, the chancellor of this university fell for what they were selling him. A right-wing media frenzy ensued. I've written a long essay on this topic called Thrashed for Theorizing, Notes on Anti-Semitism, Israel, and the Attack on Salman Rushdie. I won't say anything more on the topic. You can look it up. It's online. Make your own judgment. So one of the worst parts of this saga is that after I was smeared both in public by outside private interest groups and by my own university, after I was subjected to discriminatory treatment, private correspondence over what senior university officials were saying were leaked to me. And they were saying things like, scrutinizing my words, producing a transcript, a microscopic analysis. Oh my God, I can't believe Nader Hashemi said that. It's borderline anti-Semitic. He shouldn't have said it. But wait a second, in this other interview, he actually said something different. So perhaps, he's not as bigoted as some people are claiming. We don't know. The jury is out. And I was told by senior campus officials, and it quickly became clear to me after this crisis broke, that the senior leadership at DU had effectively accepted as a point of departure a moral framework of analysis of this crisis that was shaped by my outside accusers, that allegedly I had a problem with Jews, that I was a threat to Jewish students on campus, and the onus was on me to demonstrate that the accusations of anti-Semitism were false. And so during those early weeks of September, when the new school year began, I had to walk around this campus after being maliciously smeared with zero institutional support. Senior DU officials would tell me that I had to now prove my bona fides, that the reputation of our Center for Middle East Studies needed to be corrected, and I needed to organize a few events on anti-Semitism or on Israel that would basically restore my reputation in the eyes of my outside accusers that had slandered me. Hearing this from top DU officials felt like that proverbial attack line for which there is no defense. How many times did you beat your wife today? Prove it. This was perhaps the most humiliating, painful part of this episode. The reasons why it was so painful are numerous, and I want to quickly go over them. Number one, I'm very proud of my record as director of the Center for Middle East Studies. particularly on the question of anti-Semitism. I want everyone to know here, and I want it to go into the record, that as a director of Center for Middle East Studies, I've organized or co-sponsored not one, not two, not three, not four, but five events dealing with the very real problem of rising anti-Semitism, both historically and politically, and we're planning a sixth event next month. Moreover, as director of the Center for Middle East Studies, I hosted, inadvertently, after I was forced to do an accounting, more Jewish and Israeli speakers than I have Palestinian or Arab speakers. I've also co-sponsored about a dozen events with local Jewish organizations, mostly J Street and our Center for Judaic Studies. And finally, under my leadership, and with the help of my Israeli colleague, Mishli Ishai, I've organized an annual student trip to Israel with a West Bank option. We sent three cohorts of students to Israel before the COVID crisis hit that temporarily halted the program. Now, put this all together. Is this the behavior of an anti-Semite, as my outside accusers would have you believe? Does this track record threaten the safety and security of Jewish students, faculty, and staff on this campus, as the chancellor and provost seem to believe?
That's the voice of Dr. Nader Hashemi. He is, at least for another month or two, I guess, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. He was speaking at a panel on academic freedom at the University of Denver 10 days ago. He is with us along with Rob Prince this morning. I'm really glad that both of you are here. Would you want to comment on the story that we have just heard?
Well, I'd just like to say very quickly that the root of this controversy and scandal has absolutely nothing to do with an interview that I gave last summer. This scandal is rooted in a very long-standing attempt by right-wing supporters of Israel to police the debate on university campuses around this country on the question of Israel and Palestine, and to weaponize charges of anti-Semitism to accomplish that goal. And so this issue here, both at the University of Denver, actually has much more longer roots. Rob Prince could speak to that. But it's also happening on university campuses around this country. And it's part of an orchestrated campaign. And it's not just happening in the context of the Middle East. There are similar things happening in South Asian studies with Hindu nationalism and other forms of right-wing nationalism who try to also impose, the will of these right-wing ideological groups on university campuses by lobbying university administrators, invoking oftentimes bogus charges of racism to accomplish a political agenda. So I think that's the broad context in which we have to understand this controversy.
And we are at 303-442-4242. Invite you to join our conversation. I also wanted to mention that I sent a message to the six signatories of the statement that purports to represent the opinion of Colorado Jews. And these six are Scott Levin of the Mountain States Anti-Defamation League, Daniel Bennett of Hillel of Colorado, Rabbi Jay Streer of Jewish Colorado, Dan Lesham, Jewish Community Relations Council, Rabbi Emily Hyatt of the Rocky Mountain Rabbis and Cantors, and Aaron Hazari, Mountain States American Jewish Committee. So far, I did get, and I asked them, I'll go into a bit. I don't want to put my voice on the air too much today. We've got too many others to hear from. But I did ask them to call in, if they had a supplement to the statement that they made, I would love to read it on the air this morning. I also invited them to call in at our studio line, 303-442-4242, and speak directly with Dr. Hashemi and with our audience. I got one response that said that the speaker was out of town and that he would get back to me when he returned to Colorado. I haven't yet heard anything from the others, but I hope that we might get their response to this information. In my letter, I did say that, I suspect your signing of the statement was simply due to an oversight done because you have many demands on your time. You do not need to deliberate before defending Israel. In any case, I urge you to reconsider and discuss reasons for that. And I might go into that if there's time this morning. Rob, did you want to, as a longtime member of the faculty of DU, now out of the reach of the administration because you've been retired for a while.
Correct.
How does this come across to you?
Well, I wasn't entirely surprised by what happened, although quite disappointed. You know, the theme, at least when I was at DU of the university, was everywhere was celebrate diversity. All right. And I would say that this experience that we're seeing is not DU's finest moment. And to see, I guess, beyond the targeting of Nader, which is unprincipled and really, I don't know what word to use, but really a form of repression, if you like, that I had another concern, and that was that the Center for Middle East Studies was being targeted. And without a long explanation, the Center for Middle East Studies dealt with far more than the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. There's this tendency to look at the Middle East as if it's only Israel and Palestine. And of course, it's a big issue, but we're talking, as Nader said, a region with 20 countries with all kinds of economic and political dynamics. And the Center for Middle East Studies attempted to look at the region in its entirety, if you like. What happened before, again, without a long discussion, because we had another institute prior to Nader's forming the Center for Middle East Studies, it was called the Institute for the Study of Israel in the Middle East. And over the years, what happened is it really lost its academic focus and, in fact, was shut down. All right. And I think that was a good thing because it failed in its academic mission. Let me put it, as politely as I can. So there's
but
that.
But Nader's tenure for the current Center for Middle East Studies is 12 years.
Yes, right. Yeah, it's a long period of time. And watching the center grow in the beginning, I was a little bit part of it. It was such a difference, if you like, and at a time when universities have to deal with a world that's changing with, the speed of lightning, it's hard to keep up with the changes, including in the Middle East. You need an academic institution that's serious about looking objectively or as objectively as possible of the trends. That's what's going on, and trying to put that together and look in what way can the United States play a positive role in that region. And I believe that the Center for Middle East Studies, it was a serious effort in that direction. And it could have grown into something even more significant. And then the university would be doing its responsibility to the broader society. Now what I'm concerned about is, and Nader's recent remarks amplify that, is they want to shut the center down. And if they can't shut it down, they're probably going to neuter it. So my concern is, are we going to go back to those old days when the framework of looking at Middle East studies has become so narrow as to be really, just not objective and not helpful?
We're at 303-442-4242. I invite you to join our conversation this morning. Let me go next to it's just a minute, but on the panel addressing academic freedom at the University of Denver was Professor Karen Feste. And I think that I just picked a small clip of her remarks, but it gives you an idea what Nader has been subjected to.
When Nader's accusation was made, and here's the headline. Okay, this is from Campus Watch. Why is anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist Nader Hashemi still a faculty member of the University of Denver? This is Campus Watch. This is Jihad Watch. This is a group founded in 2003 by David Horowitz and some others. And this, the last paragraph, which was absolutely stunning to me, says, and I'll just read it to you. This was August 26, 2022. The real question is this: why is Nader Hashemi, who has now shown himself to be a crude and semi-demented conspiracy theorist, still a member of the faculty at the University of Denver? Even tenure should have its limits. Just before we met, I asked Nader had he seen this. He had not. But that was the basis of the Jerusalem Post article that is now a rightist publication, still claiming to be centrist, but we all know now it's more rightist. It's published in English, and that's what prompted, you know, the issue that faced Nader right here. So it's stunning that his case has blossomed into something just unimaginable in the 21st century, but it does relate to the hot button of this particular issue, the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
That's Professor Karen Feste.
Could I comment on
that? Of course.
Just briefly. What I want
to... But let me just say, because I forgot to mention it, I think this program is coming to you on KGNU Boulder and Denver. It's a little bit after 9 o'clock.
Right. So just briefly, Karen was attacked in a similar way to Nader 30 years ago, all right? And what Karen Feste, her expertise is conflict resolution. I learned more about international negotiations in a 10-15 minute discussion with Karen Feste that has stayed with me than I learned anywhere else. But having said that, what was Karen's contribution? What did she deserve this attack from? She had put together a rather detailed, program for how negotiations might take place and succeed to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Karen, I don't want to describe her politically because I'm not really sure where she's at, to be quite frank, but it was a very thoughtful analysis that she put together, a program that she put together that took into consideration the interests of everybody. And, you know, she was just broadsided at the time. Anyhow, I mentioned that what we're looking at here is not something that has just affected Nader, that it goes back a long time, all right? I had some incidents, I'm not going to get into them here, of being attacked, in fact, being openly attacked, along with Dean Farah in the Intermountain Jewish News and other things as well. So we're looking at something that is really, if you like, a chronic problem. And what it has tended to do for those of us in academia who are concerned about this issue, is if you're going to really talk about the issue the way you've come to understand it, you better self-censor, because if you don't, you know, somebody's behind you and somebody's going to be whispering to the dean or the chancellor. So a long-term problem. And that forum, which I attended, there were other faculty members who also spoke up about lack of administrative support, of being attacked by outside elements, whatever they were. And so what we see is an institution that has been not very responsible in defending its own faculties. And then after that, they say, well, we support freedom of speech. But that's kind of, you know, it rings false given all that experience.
Could I add something, Joel?
Of course. Yes. And I should reintroduce Dr. Nader Hashemi of the University of Denver, Center on Middle East Studies.
I think what Rob has just said has really hit the nail on the head in terms of where our focus should be. I'm less concerned about what private interest groups, right-wing political organizations say about me and my work in many ways, I take great pride that I'm criticized by organizations that have very different values than I do. But I don't really, you know, care what they have to say. The real problem here is when these organizations are successful in lobbying university administrators who then issue statements against faculty members and center directors. This is the real scandal. You can't have a serious Center for Middle East Studies to talk about an important part of the world unless the university and its senior officials are going to do their job in terms of upholding academic freedom. So that's, I think, where the focus should be. So getting back to your earlier remarks, Joel, I think you've extended an invitation to the wrong group of people to be on today's program. The people who should be invited on this program to have a conversation are the Chancellor of the University of Denver and the Provost of the University of Denver. It's their behavior that I think is really scandalous and outrageous
and the morally indefensible.
I would like to see, and with respect to the dean at the Corbell, thanks for mentioning that. I think on all things considered, the dean of the Corbell, I separate him from the chancellor and the provost. I think my dean.
And that is the Corbell School of International Studies,
right? Yeah. So
where the Center for Middle East Studies is located.
Correct, yeah. So the dean, Fritz Meyer, you know, did try to support me. I think he acted honorably. He was put in a very difficult situation trying to defend me, but effectively being forced by the chancellor to toe the party line. There are certain things that I think the dean could have done differently, but on balance, I think he acted and behaved with respect, and he did try to support me. So I want that to go out in the record. But in terms of, you know, the broader crisis and scandal and the people I think who are really responsible for producing this crisis, it's very much emanates from the office of the Chancellor of the University of Denver, which is why, you know, I don't want to get into a he said, she said argument. That's why I'm calling for an independent investigation so we can get to the root of this crisis, deal with it, and then move on.
Our studio line is 303-442-4242. I'd like to welcome Aaron to KGNU. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi there. Thanks for including me. My name is Aaron Schneider. I'm a colleague of Nader's at the University of Denver. And I just wanted to call in to say, Nader is really going to be missed. He is a top scholar of Middle East studies, of political theory. He's been a great colleague at the Corbell School of International Studies. Every academic body with understanding of the region and of what it means to be an academic and a member of the university has refuted and abhorred the mistreatment of Nader Hashemi. The Middle East Studies Association issued a statement defending Nader's expertise and his academic freedom to exercise that expertise. He's been supported by the faculty of the University of Denver, the American Academy of University Professors, the AAUP. I'm the chapter president of the University of Denver chapter of the AAUP. We have supported Nader. The Colorado Executive Committee of the AAUP has supported Nader. What he was subjected to was a violation of his academic freedom, a violation of any notion of due process. If any employee at a firm is to be reprimanded, they deserve a due process that evaluates, in fact, what happened. Nader was not given that liberty. No one checked with him before the chancellor and the provost issued a defamatory statement undermining his expertise and his character. None of this should have happened at a university where basic decisions treatment of faculty and of decisions about the way the university should operate, especially when it comes to issues of the expertise of faculty, ought to be subject to something along the lines of shared governance, in which not just the decision of a chancellor or provost rules the day, but in fact bodies in which experts like faculty, other members of the university have a voice, have a participation in evaluating what should be the path of the university. The quality of Nader's scholarship, his contribution to the field, all of that is revealed by where he's headed. We are losing Nader, a top scholar of the Middle East, to Georgetown University, a university that's higher ranked than the University of Denver and in general and in international studies. So, you know, I look at this as a self-inflicted wound by the chancellor and the provost. They damaged the university. They had every chance to preserve the reputation of the university, and they failed. And I have to ask, you know, what kind of university bends to the pressure of donors to stifle debate, to violate academic freedom, and to attack one of their own employees, one of their own faculty? So, I you know, I call in to support Nader to say that this is a crisis that that really needs to be addressed with an investigation like Nader called for, and for a real accountability for those who made this terrible decision.
Aaron, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
And we are at 303-442-4242. You know, Nader, you made the point that universities sometimes kind of go for the bucks, that they're listening to major donors who are conditioning the contributions they will make on whether their ideas of who should be teaching or not are respected. There's another case of that you bring up, surprisingly to me, at Harvard, whose middle name is trillions of dollars in endowment, for the same kind of thing, and they can't be doing it for the money. How should we understand that?
That's a great question, Joel. I think the best way of understanding why university administrators often bend to the pressure of private interest groups and donors is because university administrators, particularly the top officials, that's the world in which they inhabit. They deal with, they hang out with potential donors. Harvard is an interesting case because they're certainly not short of money, which raises the question, why did the dean at the Harvard Kennedy School, you know, block a fellowship for Kenneth Roth from Human Rights Watch, generating a global scandal? But I think that's the best explanation that I can come up with, that there is a certain culture, a certain attitude that senior administrators have where the donors always, you know, have the benefit of the doubt. And and university administrators bend in that direction. There is a connection here, I think, to the broader crisis of democracy that we're facing in this country. In other words, you know, we have people who are involved in democratic institutions. They're senior administrators, whether they're university officials or whether they're congressmen and women. These people are often lobbied, you know, by outside private interest groups to represent the will of private interest groups. And these officials, whether it's a university chancellor or a member of Congress, there are all these key moments where they have to make a decision, and they have to sort of, you know, really reflect deeply on the decisions that they have to make after being heavily lobbied. And sadly, we see time and time again, it's the interest and the influence of private donors and big money, whether it be, you know, big pharma, the oil industry, the gun lobby, the NRA, or in the context of the Middle East, the pro-Likud lobby, that often has a huge amount of influence. And we see, you know, these officials, whether they're in Congress or whether they're in Denver, you know, bending to the will of these private donors. And I think it really represents in many ways a moral failing of those individuals who make these types of decisions during a moment of crisis. That's the best way I can interpret and explain what's going on here. And I think it has to change.
We're at 303-442-4242. I'm Joel Edelstein talking with Dr. Nader Hashemi and fellow faculty member Rob Prince. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Lynn. Good morning, Lynn. You're on KGNU.
Yeah, well, if it's any consolation, Nader, I called out Bill Ritter on an oil and gas, renewable energy. Are you Denver U?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Denver U. Renewable energy, oil and gas policy conference that they had every year about 5 or 7 years ago. And I got thrown out of the meeting. Like, I was talking to some people at the break, and they threw me out. It was just, it was stunning. They didn't have the courage to do it right when I asked the question. You know, it was, like, stunning. But I'm very pro-Palestinian, but I'm Jewish. So I can see the way they do it. And you know what this is? Is this is causing moral injury to the universities from which these kind of things happen. And it really defames the, that institution.
Thanks very much, Lynn. We still are at 303-442. And following Lynn, let's go to Don. Good morning, Don. You're on KGNU.
Yes, this is John, John Maynard Lee. I've been an English professor, and when I left academia, battling over tenure, which was a messy situation, I just would say a couple of things. Business people started taking over the presidencies of universities. This is a very general statement, but in the sort of maybe the 80s and 90s. And so faculties didn't necessarily have the power which they perhaps had before. And universities operate on different models, of course. But in this case, obviously, the one avenue it would be to try to get faculties to rise up. But the problem is that people and faculties are protected by academic freedom. That's not a problem. That's what we need. So that what Nutter has just said here about the failing of the top administrators is a major issue. But the level of the top administrators is to protect the whole institution. And basic sociology says that we are always going to protect the institution. That's what we do. So I wonder what Dick Lamb would have said to this, for one thing. And I'm glad to see that you guys have certainly taken on the AAUP as a major source of looking into this.
Don,
2001... No. This is Joe, I'm just getting to what I want to talk about here, really.
Okay, because we've got other people that want to speak as well.
But what I need is to talk about is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I've written a play about that when I started in 2001. It has two families that talk about the whole issue in very reasonable, controversial terms, of course, the Israeli family and the Palestinian family. But it works out a solution for the whole thing by basically taking on the extremist position of the Jews who attacked Nader and the whole situation here and maintain these lobbies and things. So the play, I mean, when I left academia, I went into real politics. I joined the Democratic Party in Boulder, which I was the platform chairman for 8 years. And Jim Worth asked me to come in and write for the State Department based on some of my campaign writing and stuff. So I'm just saying that... Well, I don't know. I just wanted to put forward that I've written this play, and it may have something to say to the intimate nature of the controversy, but there's no level to the depths to which cowardice, ignorance, and prejudice will go.
John, thanks very much. Dan, you're on KGNU. Good morning.
With some interest, what Rob Prince was saying and Mr. Hashemi was saying also, and skirting around the real key to why these kinds of things happen and you don't get support, it's the dictum, and I've been an administrator, don't make waves. You can virtually do anything you want at a university if no one complains about it, if no one hears about it. Once there's pressure put on you, you fold. That's the case at the U, where I've taught in the past. I've also taught at other schools. And that's what I wanted to just compliment them on getting to the root of the problem, is don't make waves,
yes,
and you can do anything you want. Thank you.
Just very, very quickly, in response to Dan and the caller before, one of the things that is missing from the discussion, I think, is faculty organization. Well, Aaron mentioned it briefly, but the more the faculty is organized, it's more difficult for the administration to pull this kind of nonsense. So in the case of DU, I can't emphasize the importance of the faculty joining and being actively involved in AAUP or whatever union it is that's really, in the end, a really key element to defending academic freedom. And without that, we're forced to fight as individuals, if you like, and that's always more difficult and challenging.
Yeah, I just wanted to add and echo that sentiment. I want to also thank Aaron for calling in. He's been a huge source of support for me during this crisis. If we had a faculty union, I don't think I would be on your program, Joel, today, because a faculty union who could represent my interests with the senior administration based on a collective bargaining agreement would inhibit the university from treating faculty the way that I was treated. And I think that's a big gap here that I always realized existed, but I didn't understand the importance of a faculty union until this crisis erupted last summer.
And again, we're at 303-442-4242. We just got a few minutes left of the program. If you wanted to get in a few words, this would be a good time to do it. And we're going to go to, to Tim. Good morning, Tim. You're on KGNU.
Hi, it's Tim. There was an article by James Bamford on Democracy Now! And in Nation, and it said that the Trump campaign had help from, or there was this plot by the Israeli government to influence the election of Trump and defeat Hillary Clinton. And he was claiming that this was part, the FBI had found some things that seemed to indicate this was way more than any Russiagate, that Israel was plotting both something about contributing money to elections in the U.S. and also about hacking things, things that would be released about the DNC and Hillary Clinton's emails. Anyway, it sounds crazy, but...
Yeah, I haven't heard anything like that.
Security.
I mean, what we do know is that AIPAC, the American Israeli PAC, I guess, it wasn't a PAC, but now it is, they've contributed about $30 million in the last election to support the competitors with progressive Democrats who support Palestinian rights. And in some cases, those dollars from AIPAC have gone to Trump Republicans.
Wow.
So, you know, there is certainly a political phenomenon occurring. I haven't heard anything about the 2016 election.
Yeah, it's in Nation by Bamford. Yeah, no. It was April 3rd.
There's something to what the caller is speaking about. It's
great.
Been reported. Yeah.
Jim, thank you so much. And again, we're at 303-442-4242. And Lynn is back, I guess.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing. I heard that Trump was put into office because he agreed to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and that it was, you know, not just Hunter Biden's computer.
Well, that may have played a role. We've got about 5 minutes left. The subject that caused this event to happen, the treatment of Nader Hashemi, that I won't say it caused it, because I concur with Nader that really it has to do with positions on equality of rights for Palestinians. But the overt item that was cited by the six organizations claiming to represent the Jewish community of Colorado had to do with his 52-second comment on an obscure podcast
that 10 people listened to,
saying that there are three possible reasons why there was this attack on Salman Rushdie coinciding with the negotiations to restore the Iran nuclear deal. One of them was that Nader said it was pure coincidence, perhaps. There's nobody that put this 24-year-old up to it. The other was that it was forces in Iran that don't want the deal to go through and that they thought the attack on Rushdie would break down the progress to reaching an agreement. And the third possibility was that Mossad was involved. And they referred to Nader's comment as fanciful. And I just wanted to say that the idea that the Mossad would be involved in attacking or assassinating someone is not fanciful. The authoritative source on this is a book called Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. And Ronan Bergman, who is the author of that book, notes that Israel actually has assassinated more people than any other Western country in the world. And who is Ronan Bergman? Well, his book, according to Haaretz, says, leading any list of notable nonfiction books, Jewish or not, must be Ronan Bergman's Rise and Kill First, a massive and extravagantly well-sourced history of the use of the tool of assassination by Israel's intelligence services. This is not fanciful to think that Mossad would be involved here. And I'll just say that Roman Bergman has won every award for a journalist that Israel has, including awards by B'nai B'rith International Press Award, and others. He's graduated with honors from the University of Haifa Faculty of Law and clerked for the Attorney General's office. I mean, you can't say that what Nader's speculation, among others, was fanciful. It was totally appropriate for someone who has the portfolio and expertise of Dr. Nader Hashemi.
Yes, well, can Nader. I say something?
Indeed. We're just about out of time.
Yeah, very quickly. The outrageous nature of the attack on me was rooted in this very bogus argument that somehow my critical discussion of the Israeli Mossad is equivalent to blaming Jews for what happened to Salman Rushdie. That's an argument that just is, you know, laughable at face value, because to claim that argument would then, you know, force us to sort of, by logic, assume that, you know, if we criticize the, you know, intelligence services of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we're attacking all Muslims. Or if we criticize the intelligence services of the Chinese state, we are criticizing all Chinese. So this speaks to the very pernicious nature of the attack on me. And I think, you know, we have to start pushing back on these attempts to weaponize charges of racism against people who are totally innocent. That's really the core of the problem here that I think needs to be part of the discussion.
Thank you, Nader. Thank you, Nader Hashemi. Thank you also to Rob Prince for being with us this morning. Thanks to our excellent callers, as usual. Thanks to Nancy for handling the calls, as she always does. I'll be back in 2 weeks with an interview with Stephen Simon, who spent almost 40 years in the higher levels of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, including the National Security Council, his experience in the sausage factory where foreign policy is made. And Rob Prince will join me along with Ibrahim Kazaruni. That's on May 5th here on Connections. I'm Joel Edelstein. Thanks for listening.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Walk your talk.
Talk your talk. KGNU Talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30
on KGNU.